Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch Blackpool. For more information, please visit ccblackpool.co.uk.
It's so good to be here. So, my name's Dave. I'm here with my wife Jo and our three kids. Coming here feels like coming to visit friends. I grew up with a lot of these guys. You know, we're in our early 20s as a bunch of singletons in Salford, and then we all married up and had kids. And Ben and Jen and I did various different kids clubs together, led a small group together, led alpha courses together. Joe lived with Nicola before they were married, was privileged enough to see Damon go on his kind of those early steps of his journey of faith. And since we've kind of ministered together, doing alpha course away days together, where Damon is probably the best alpha speaker I've ever heard. He is amazing. So look at him squirm. And he's handsome, he's intelligent, full of charisma. It's being recorded, man. So coming here, I don't come to lecture you, I come as a friend to encourage you and lift your sight. So I forgot John and Beck, who absolutely we kind of grew up together, and Beck lived across the road from me. John was that guy at church that used to pray about our church reaching the unlovely and the unlovable, and just kind of stirred us again and again. And it was funny, I remember there was that time in our church where we realized that we had kind of various different barometers of the Holy Spirit. So if God was there and beginning to do stuff, then James Casey would pick up on it first. And then Nicola would kind of start to twitch. And then when you know you got John, you had the kind of the Brucey bonus, and like God was really at work in the church service. It's like they were the three barometers of spiritual temperature. You can edit that bit out of the talk, right? So yeah, it's going to be a little bit interactive, a little bit. We'll finish on a point where I'm going to ask you guys to do stuff. So just to warm you up, I want to see how many of you remember this well-worn phrase. It's an all-play game. Feel free to shout out if you think you know it. So the phrase is, I agree with. Can anybody remember the ending of that phrase? I agree with. It's on the tip of your tongue. And you're thinking, surely it can't be. There we go. I agree with Nick. 2010, general election, all the political leaders were on TV together and they were literally queuing up to say, I agree with Nick, the Liberal Democrat leader. Put Liberal Democrats on the map. Hadn't been anywhere before. Mr. Nice But Dim Nick, everybody queuing up to say, I agree with Nick. And Joe, if you type into I agree with on Google, it will finish the sentence for you. I agree with Nick. Even 7 years on. If you type in I agree with Nick and then click on images in Google, you get pictures of Nick Clegg's face with the phrase I agree with Nick and all sorts of neon colours. It defined that general election. It absolutely did. And it's kind of ingrained in people's memory that you can ask people 7 years on to finish the phrase. And wherever you ask people, they do. So we've just had a general election. You remember that? Not so distant kind of memory. And it was defined for me by a really interesting battle. That kind of the media and the social media kind of defined it as the battle between Corbyn and May. They kind of almost counted out everybody else. So the 2010 election was all about kind of these smaller parties coming to the fore and playing a role. This one, somehow it got shaped in such a way, just those two. And she wanted it to all be, what was her catchphrase? There we go. Not so strong and stable right now, but never mind. Can't see everything ahead of time, can we? She wanted it to be about one thing. And then somehow this media machinery and social media machinery defined it as something else. The battle between good and evil. It was Frodo versus Sauron. Harry Potter versus Voldemort, Skywalker versus Vader, Arnie versus the Predator, whichever one of those you plug into, probably defined by your generation. It was, so the caricature was, there's Theresa May that wants to single-handedly strip away the fabric of our society, and there's Jeremy Corbyn that is going to single-handedly save the NHS, education, look after old people, and even babysit your kids for the weekend if you ask them. That was the caricature. And underneath that, there was this whole thing about what is the role of the state in terms of looking after people. that was essentially what people wanted, or kind of shaped the battleground around. And you kind of ask the question, where did that come from? And it's something that's quite particular to our English culture. So post-war Britain, there was this thing called the Beveridge Report that changed the whole of our culture. And it was the beginning of, let me read out my notes so I don't miss any out, the beginning of national insurance, sick pay, annual leave, pensions, free education, unemployment benefits, and the NHS. Just because of that report and the changes that happened afterwards, all of those things began to emerge in our culture. And we kind of take them for granted now, assume they've always been there. Massively influenced by the church, by the way, and this notion of human dignity. And what it did in that report was take away this notion of deserving and undeserving. Took it away and said that actually the government has a role in looking after the whole community, not just some. Now in the 1980s we had this kind of thing where the NHS had kind of been a victim of its own success and couldn't possibly keep up with demand, and there was all sorts of other things going on that meant Margaret Thatcher tried to roll it all back a little bit and saying actually no, we want it to be slightly different. And that's one of the reasons why she's so unpopular. That's one of the reasons why people are so keen to kind of put Theresa May's face next to Margaret Thatcher's face, that kind of whole thing. And then David Cameron in 2015 started to use this phrase which was about an underclass. Do you remember that? And what he invited us to do at that point was to start to think again about those that deserved help and those that didn't deserve help. And it's a kind of almost like this antiquated Elizabethan notion. They had the poor law back in the 1600s, and it had four groups that it talked about. So the poor law talked about children and the aged and the infirm, that's two, the genuinely unemployed, and the willfully idle. And the first three, the children, the old people, and those that had fallen on hard times, they were to be helped, and the willfully idle were to be punished. And often that involved being shipped off to another country. So right now, our society faces these challenges. We've got austerity, personal debt, benefit cuts, housing kind of shortages, service cutbacks, unemployment, economic inequality that's increasing, substance abuse, gang culture, youth crime, trafficking and exploitation, and all of those are on your doorstep. And we've got this challenge, like, whose fault is it? Is it the government's fault? This government? Future government? And whose responsibility is it to try and fix it? Is it the poor that are to blame for themselves? Are they actually just work-shy, couch-potato Jeremy Kyle fodder, cheating a benefit system? Or is there something more going on? And there's a resurgence in our country of suspicion towards those that are in need of help, which again feeds into this debate around what's the government's responsibility in fixing all of that? And each time they do a cut to public services, what they're saying is, this isn't our responsibility. And so there's this debate, what is the role of the state? And I come to you today to say, not the answer to that question, I come to you today to say there's no such debate about the role and responsibility of the church. There's no debate. Archbishop John Armani stood up in front of the House of Lords and he said that scroungers, or the terminology of scroungers, is a convenient scapegoat when it seems expedient to make sure someone else pays the price for the hardship that we fear. But the church has always been in the forefront of the challenge to speak and act prophetically, to give a voice to the voiceless and hope and help to those in need. The church has always been on the forefront of the challenge to speak and act prophetically and give a voice to those that need hope and help. Jesus reached his early 30s and reached that point where he was about to announce his manifesto, what he stood for. He stands up in the temple. He comes to the front.
He opens the Old Testament scriptures and chooses a passage to read that defines him. So important was it to him that he aligned himself with the right people that this is the verse he chose. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. He could have chosen any passage he wanted to capture his heart. He could have chosen any passage he wanted to define his manifesto. But he chose this: good news to the poor, freedom for prisoners, recovery for the sick, and freedom for the oppressed. So the question remains, was it just good politics? Or was it actually who he was? And time and again, we see Jesus align himself with those that are most vulnerable. And we're going to focus in on one of those occasions today. It's in Mark chapter 5. If you've got a Bible and you want to go there, you can. But don't worry if you haven't, because I'm going to read it to you. So it goes a bit like this. Jesus and his disciples came to the other side of the sea, to the country of Gerasenes. None of you have been there. I could have said anything, couldn't I? To the country of Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he'd often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him and cried out with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me. Do not torment me." This description is absolutely tragic. It's really tragic. This is a man living alone among the tombstones, living on the other side of the water, away from the rest of the community. Afflicted by an unclean spirit, so tormented that he was angry and unsoothable. He was unrestrainable. He could not be subdued. He was unable to sleep at night, and so spent the nights howling at the sky and cutting his own skin with stones. This was not a gentle whimper, a moaning of having stubbed his toe. This is a roaring at the skies in torment. We aren't actually told how he got there, but he's alone, and he's branded unclean, afflicted, untreatable, untamable, and unlovable. We aren't told what he was like as a child. We aren't told if he was a naughty kid or a good kid. We aren't told whether he went through some kind of trauma or whether he'd always been this way. We aren't told what his family were like, whether they were good, bad, indifferent, abusive, loving. We aren't told. But we are told that his anger and his abusive behaviour left him separated. Even his family disowned him. The whole community would have him on the other side of the water at arm's length. Fear and ignorance turned this community to abuse this man, because they tried to tie him up. They tried to chain him up. We aren't told why. Maybe it was to administer first aid. Maybe it was to administer medical care. Maybe to try and do some kind of deliverance. Maybe to stop him from hurting other people or breaking things. We aren't told why. But it's this tragic mix between kind of barbaric medieval medical treatment and the kind of treatment that the Incredible Hulk gets in the latest Marvel film. People are afraid of him. And they turn from being community and belonging to abusers that push him out.
And I wonder how often our society's treatment of people actually compounds their level of isolation, actually compounds their vulnerability, actually makes the situation worse rather than better. I think sometimes the way communities treat people actually compounds the amount of room that the devil has to work in people's lives. Because the more we isolate them and the more we ostracize them, the more vulnerable they are to demonic influence. Yeah, I just used two D words. Is that allowed here?
Yeah.
Okay. They're not four-letter D words, they're just D words. Let me be clear. I am not saying everybody who's poor or sick or unemployed or isolated has a demon. I'm not saying that at all. Not even close. Don't even go there. It's not even helpful in the discussion. What I am drawing the comparison with, though, is how a community treats its most vulnerable. What I am drawing the comparison is how a society, even a church, treats those people that are most vulnerable. I wonder how your church treats those that need extra work and extra grace and extra affection and extra care. I wonder how flexible we are with our Sunday morning routines to accommodate those people that maybe struggle to plug into them. You see, it seems like every time you read the news with a natural disaster, it's always the poor that are hit hardest, right? A tsunami wave hits, it's their homes that aren't protected because they're on the level. A fire hits in a tower block, it's always the poor that are hit hardest. Where there's a natural disaster, it's always those that can't afford medical treatment that are afflicted by the diseases that last for generations afterwards. And it's like this systemic injustice thing that just exists the whole world over, that those that are most in need of help are those that are hit hardest when things go wrong. And you meet those families where it just feels like there's one thing on top of another, and you sometimes sit with them and you hear their story and you're like, what do these guys have to do to get a break? Start, reflecting the other day, like, our life is busy and we kind of have all the pegs in the right holes and we kind of run through. And actually, I feel like we could kind of absorb some stuff that hits us. But there are just other families that you kind of spend time with and you just think, they're just one crisis to the next. And just at the moment where they feel like they're hitting a bit of hope, something else just seems to come. When Jesus approaches this guy, the guy's reaction is really telling. He says, what are you going to do with me now? Don't torment me. See, that tells me that other religious leaders have come to this guy to fix the problem and have in fact just tormented him. And my prayer for you and my prayer for my church is that we would never be a place where those that are most in need of help actually just come and find more judgment, more torment, more mistreatment. In fact, it costs to love people when their behaviour pushes you away. It costs. It is not something that is easy. If you guys are going to position yourself in the middle of Blackpool, it is going to cost you to love those people who most need help. Guaranteed. There's no avoiding it. We're in Salford. If we're going to reach the community of Salford, it is going to cost us to love those people that most need it. It isn't going to be comfortable. It isn't going to be smooth. It isn't going to be a nice positive correlation graph. The more effort you put in, the more impact you get out. It's going to be like this. There's going to be highs. There's going to be lows. There's going to be moments where you thought they were going to get baptized and then something else just comes and hits and it's like out of the door again. It just will be. It's true. No avoiding it. Now, I know those of you that know this story will have realised that I stopped at a very particular point. And you'll be sitting there going, but what about the pigs? You are. Yeah. If you know the story, you're there, and your modern sensibilities are like, why did the poor blasted pigs end up over the cliff? Do you know the story? So Jesus cast the demon out of the unclean man, and they go into the pigs, and the whole herd of pigs ends up running themselves over a cliff. It's awkward, that, isn't it? And I did some research. I read some stuff about what was going on in the spiritual realm at this point. What motivated Jesus? And some of the theories had more value than others. Some of them were tosh. Be careful what you read on the internet. But allow me to just sow a thought in your head. Often, when Jesus is interacting with people, some of his behaviour sometimes seems strange. And I think that's because he sees what we don't see. That he sees people's hearts. And often when Jesus is talking to people, he's not really speaking to their heads. He's speaking to their hearts. So we see Jesus in the temple turning over tables because he sees the heart of the people that are turning God's house into a place of making money. We see Jesus talk to the rich young ruler, and the rich young ruler says, well, I'm keeping all the commands. What do I need to do to know that I'm going to be in heaven? And Jesus speaks right into his heart and says, just give away all your money. See how that fits. Because he knows it's the one thing that's going to turn the man on a sixpence. And I think at this point, Jesus is acting in a way that speaks to the heart of the community. See, the transformation in this man is incredible. To the point where we're told in a bit that he is there in fresh clothes, freshly washed, freshly shaven, eating calmly and sensibly. And the Bible tells us the people were afraid. They couldn't even bring themselves to celebrate the transformation of this man. They were simply afraid. And I think in sending those pigs over the side, Jesus was touching something in this community. These guys ask Jesus to leave after this. They see the most amazing display of power. They see Jesus do something in an instant that the whole community has been unable to do throughout this whole man's life. They've tied him up, they've chained him up, they've cast him out, they've done all sorts of stuff, and he's still in a mess. He's still howling at the night sky. I would have been celebrating Jesus simply by virtue of the fact that I was going to get a decent night's sleep without Howling Boy out there. And yet they ask him to leave. Why? It is not because they're animal rights campaigners. It's not because they're vegetarians. It's because right there in those pigs is the local economy. Right there in those pigs is pounds, shillings and pence. And I think what Jesus is doing at this moment is saying to these guys, you lie in your beds, religious people, congratulating yourself at your religious observance about how pious and pure you are. And yet, meanwhile, there is this vulnerable child of God out among the tombstones howling at the night sky. Do you not see that inconsistency? To the point where this man is transformed and all you can do is be afraid. And I'm going to exaggerate it even further. This man has been transformed and you're worried about your bank account. You're worried about your local economy. God is at work in your midst and you are worrying about how much it costs. He puts his finger right on the heart of the community and they ask him to leave. Just be careful, guys. You are setting yourselves up to see God do incredible things in your community. Do not ask him to leave when he starts doing it. Don't worry about how much it costs. Don't worry about the finance. Don't worry about the time. When Jesus starts to do stuff in your community, when he starts to do stuff here, when he starts to do stuff out there, make space for him to do it. Because you do not want to get to 10 years down the line and say to each other, do you remember that time Jesus visited and he started to break some chains and we asked him to leave because it didn't fit our bank balance or our Sunday morning schedule? When Jesus starts to do stuff in your midst, make the space, make the sacrifice, and know you'll never look back and wonder what if. Don't look back and wonder what if. So the good news is, with all of this, is it's another story of gentle Jesus, meek and mild, right? And people don't howl at the sky anymore, do they? So it's okay. And the whole spiritual realm thing, we've kind of nailed that because we've got science now and we've got medication. And so it's all good. Not a problem anymore. And that creeps in to our mindset, creeps into my mindset. Until I was coming out of work the other day and there's a guy stood on the corner in disheveled clothes, looking unkempt. Literally, I can't do it without falling over, but literally rocking backwards and forwards on his ankles, just howling at the sky. Street corner, middle of a shopping precinct, the community did not notice. This man was invisible, just howling away, invisible. He might as well have been on the other side of the water. And on the same day, I was driving my son home from one of his activities and we arrived home in the evening and there's this man walking up our street and I see him stop every 20 meters or so and just starts to bang his leg, banging it and sitting on the wall and just shouting and expletives. So I ushered Luke into the house so that he wouldn't learn any words he didn't need to know. And just went and had a chat with him. I was like, what's going on? And this man begins to unfold this story and he's at odds with everybody. He's got this kind of leg injury that means he can barely walk and he's suing the hospital for medical incompetence and he's in sheltered accommodation and he's got no family around and he just seems to be at odds with all the services. He's been sanctioned for benefits and just everything just seems to be coming in the same direction and all the structures of the community that are meant to be there, he's at odds with them. Now, I know that some of that's his fault and some of that's their fault and some of it's just the rigidity of the system and it all just falls down in the middle. But the very fact is he's just on his own, on the other side of the water, among the tombs, howling at the sky, banging himself. And I said to him, like, where are you going now? He said, oh, I live on the edge of Walkden. Those of you that know Salford, from us, that's about 4 or 5 miles. I said, like, how are you going to get there? He said, oh, don't worry. I'm ex-military. I'll get there one way or another. I was just like, man, this guy used to be at the center of our society. This guy laid his best of his years down to defend our society. And now he is at odds with the whole deal. Stopping every 20 meters to bang himself and shout because he is on his own. It's not just a story about gentle Jesus, meek and mild. It's not. And I think sometimes as Christians we have a proximity problem. Do you know what I mean by that? We're just not close enough. So we, by being away from poverty, by being away from vulnerability, we kind of believe that it's either not there or it's their own fault. And Jesus doesn't want us to have a proximity problem. He doesn't want us to be on the other side of the water to the problem. He wants us to be close enough so that we can hear the story and know the story and feel the pain and be in it with them. And do you know what? I love that Jesus aligns himself with the marginalized. I honor his kingship. I marvel at his splendor and the beauty of creation. I'm in awe of his spine-tingling purity. But when I see him align himself with the marginalized, I love him for it. I just love it every time. Recently, over my half term, I was doing this residential for some young people, and these are all young people with kind of complex needs, all sorts going on, but the thing that kind of combines them all is they're all excluded from school, and so we take them away to North Wales and just kind of do some outward bound stuff and try to just kind of tell them the beginnings of the gospel and give them an opportunity to understand that God loves them. And my friend, on the last night we were doing a campfire, my friend stands up and tells his story. And he's got an amazing story where he's kind of just been released from all kinds of fear and anxiety and addiction and suicidal tendencies to the point where he's now living life for Jesus and loving it. And so he tells them this story. But part of his story is about actually being quite an abusive husband or father. And so afterwards, the girl just kind of sidles up to me at this campfire, a young girl, 14, and she starts to tell me her life story. And she tells me about this this row that happened in our family, an almighty row, the sort of thing I can't even imagine. And it got to the point where every single member of the family had packed their suitcases. And it was like kind of showdown at the OK Corral, you know, either you go or we go. And her dad leaves on that day. But he, his family live around the corner, so he just goes around the corner. But this girl says she never heard from him. From the moment he walked out that door, she never heard from him. And she said she found it crushing. She said it was like he treated her like a bottle of shampoo left in a hotel room. Don't worry, I'll just get another one. It was like, easy come, easy go. And she said she'd never been an easy kid. But at that point, things just started to go down the pan. She had this amazing, crushing sense of worthlessness. And she started to self-harm, which spiraled out of control to the point where she was self-harming in the classroom. And the school said, we can't keep you in the classroom cutting yourself. So they referred her on. They moved her out, confirming the message that actually your dad was right. You are just a bottle of shampoo that we can leave behind. You are not worth keeping. And she told me this whole story with a whole bunch of other details with just this, like it wasn't at all shocking. Like that was what she was worth. That was it. And I felt the still small voice of God say, speak to her heart. Don't worry about how much she understands about what you say. Just speak to her heart. So I told her that her dad sounded like an idiot. Not a stellar start, really. But what I meant was, and what I went to go on to say, is that she shouldn't measure her worth through her dad. That she should measure her worth by her Father in heaven. That the Father that knit her together in her mother's womb delighted in every hair, every bone, every vein. I told her that in those moments where she descends into despair, self-loathing, and reaches out for a blade to cut herself, that he weeps, not in judgment, but in raw sorrow and affection for her. I told her that any moment she considers herself without worth, she should look to the cross. And on the cross, she would see Jesus clinging to nails for dear life because he chose to. Because he couldn't bear the thought of letting go and leaving her behind. And that she would always know, anytime she looked at the cross, that God considered her too precious to leave behind. That he clung to those nails, that she never needs to be separated from her father ever again. And I told her that my dad left when I was a baby. And I spent my whole childhood trying to prove that I was worth something. And then God broke in as I was a 19-year-old and told me that actually he saw through all of that nonsense. And to be honest, I hadn't really achieved that much anyway. But he still loved me. And I said that my dad is her dad. And that just as my dad loves me, he loves her. In fact, that he's crazy about her. So crazy about her that he's going to heal her heart just in the same way as he's going to heal the cuts on your arms, your legs and your tummy. I was like, oh, crap. You're allowed to say that here? Is it, that is a fallout word, isn't it? But that's what I thought. I was like, oh, man, why have I said that? Why have I said that out loud to a vulnerable teenage girl? That's all kinds of unprofessional, and I totally can't deliver on that promise. And that's rule number one of working with vulnerable people: don't make promises you can't deliver. And I've just gone and done it. So I said to her, do you know what, I can't do that. I can't just heal your skin. So we'd best ask God to, right? So me and one of the female members of staff, we just stood there and we just prayed for a moment and asked God to heal her skin. And I said, amen. And then I opened my eyes and we kind of stood there and kind of did this. It's a bit like, what do you do now? You know, this is a bit awkward, isn't it? But she was like, yeah. And so off she toddled. And then that evening, she's there with one of the female members of staff putting her to bed, because that's what we do in these campuses. We put them to bed like parents would. And this member of staff is putting her to bed. And she gives her life to Jesus. And she's just amazing. Oh, it's just like, Jesus aligns himself with the marginalized and the broken. Then you guys are really lucky that I'm doing this talk today, because you get the end of the story. Because she emailed me on Friday out of the blue, and she said, this is my last day at this school. I'm off to college. I'm going to college to do hair and beauty. I've got my maths exams. And guess what? Jesus healed my scars. Just incredible. Like, you're right. You've heard that the presence of God is in here, right? Isn't that incredible? A slip of the tongue moment that led to a prayer just opened the door for the God of the universe to align himself with somebody broken. All from a moment, a still small voice from God that says, speak to her heart. Speak to her heart. And I believe that actually there's a still small voice for you guys here that says, speak to the heart of Blackpool. Speak to the heart of the individuals that you meet. Don't worry how much they understand. Don't worry how much of the theology you get right. Just speak to the heart. Tell me, what would your desire be for this town? What would it be? It's an all-play game. What would your desire be for this town? Say again? Yes, answer. Otherwise, I'm going to stand here a long time. What would it be? Tell me. Little things. What would you? This is the all-play bit. What would you want to see happen in this town?
Addicts set free.
Addicts set free. Yeah. Yeah. What else? No homelessness.
Amazing.
Say again?
Yeah, I was just saying getting people off the streets.
People off the streets, yes. Definitely. What else? What would you want to see?
The end of sexual exploitation.
Oh, awesome. Great.
I'd like to see groups of teenagers talking about Jesus.
Yeah, definitely.
Was it?
Yeah. What else? What else do you want to see? Yeah. What else did you want to see?
Big massive church
and
people in families.
Yeah, and maybe that's not like your 2.4 kind of one parent, two parent thing. Maybe it's just a crazy old family of people just thrown together, almost a bit like a church. Because you guys are a bunch of misfits, just like my church. Yeah. All thrown together. The Bible calls it grafted in. That's a nice word for misfits. Yeah. There's the vine, and you guys get picked up from wherever you are, and you get grafted in. A sense of belonging. That's my longing, is to see misfits grafted in and belonging. Suddenly fitting, not misfitting. You know, the church should be full of the crankiest, bizarrest mix of people. Sometimes people say, I love God, I don't have a problem with God, but I have a problem with the church, because the church is full of hypocrites. I'm like, of course it is. Church is full of the most messed up bunch of people you've ever met, and that's the whole beauty of it. That's the whole point of the gospel, is it's a whole bunch of people that have realised that they can't do it by themselves, so they come together all under the one banner of the blood of Jesus that joins them together, grafted into a vine. It's going into a whole other talk, but you know that with citrus fruit, you can kind of take different types of citrus and you can graft them into vines where they don't belong to, and they bear new fruit. But you can take one citrus and put it onto another citrus vine, and it will start to grow a different kind of fruit because it's been grafted into a different vine. That's what's happened with you guys, is that you've been grafted into God's family, grafted into God's church, and that means you now start to bear a whole different kind of fruit from what you used to. See, when I was 19, I used to strive, work hard, try and make your own salvation. That was my family ethos. And then God took me and grafted me into a different family, and now suddenly I bear a different fruit. Suddenly I'm on an adventure with Jesus. I felt like a rebel without a cause, kind of lost and broken. And then suddenly God gave me a cause that wasn't about my striving, but my belonging. But I belong to something that means the fruit that grows through me will be different to that fruit. That's what we pray for Blackpool, right? But Blackpool can be grafted into something and the fruit might be different. You know, Manchester and Blackpool are joined together in a really unsavory way. I work with young people in Manchester that are picked up by
leaders of gangs off the streets because they're vulnerable. They take their phones off them and they take them out of the community and they bring them to Blackpool to sell drugs on your streets. That's my kids in my school. They come to your streets to sell your people drugs. And there was a time when services used to say our boys would be boys. Bad lads will end up in gangs. And then there was this wake-up call that was around the same thing with CSE, where they, because there was a time when they used to say that girls that were got involved in sexual exploitation were child prostitutes. There's no such thing as a child prostitute. A child cannot make a career decision to become a child prostitute. They are victims of exploitation. And they've made the same jump, which is the right jump, around gangs, is that lads cannot make an informed decision to become drug dealers. Actually, it has been reclassified as human trafficking. Manchester and Blackpool are linked together by human trafficking. And my prayer is that actually part of the reason why I think God makes families of churches, like New Frontiers, like Christ Central Churches, part of the reason he makes families of churches and puts them in different locations is that there can be streams of living water that flow between them that mutually impact both communities. So Ben says to me, will you come preach in Blackpool? Yeah, because my community is linked to your community, and it's not just by the evil that people would do, it's by the presence of God and the purposes of God, and we're grafted into the same vine and we can bring different fruit to these communities, and we can speak to the communities of Blackpool, we can speak to the communities of Manchester, and we can see a different fruit. You with me?
Yeah.
So I'd like us to finish by speaking to the heart of this community. I'd like to stand with me in a moment, and we're just going to kind of do it all together, out loud, like we're a little bit crazy. Smart. Yeah? Don't worry about the person next to you. Don't worry about the person in front of you, the person behind you. I want you to speak to the heart of the community. And what I want you to say is what you want to happen for that community. The best that you could imagine for the people that live on your street, the people in your workplace, the people in your clubs, the people that walk along this promenade. What's the best you could imagine for this community? Start to speak it out over them. Somebody told me once that the beginnings of prophecy is looking at a broken situation and believing that it doesn't have to stay broken. That's prophecy. That's what Ezekiel did over the Valley of Dry Bones. He looked at a broken community and God told him it doesn't have to stay broken. That's what God stirred in me with that young girl. A broken young lady doesn't have to stay broken. And that's what we're going to do with Blackpool this morning, is say that a community that contains brokenness doesn't have to stay broken.
Thank you for listening. For more information, downloads and podcasts, please visit ccblackpool.co.uk.